the next few weeks, for those who return for the other shiurim that will be given on the topic of chinuch, may seem very obvious, and it's for that reason why it's so important that we gather here, and very often that which is most obvious needs to be stated and we need to be reminded of on a frequent basis, not to take for granted that which is obviously most important in life and requires constant chizuk. As I mentioned, this is a tremendous opportunity and endeavor which this sisterhood has undertaken. We invest a lot of money in Jewish education. I know that everybody in the room puts a tremendous amount of time and effort into their own career and family building just so we can send our children to yeshiva. And there is a tendency that people sometimes have to want to believe that as long as we send them off to the yeshiva and we're happy with the education that they're getting and we feel that they have good teachers and they're coming back with good grades, so we can be pretty much, we can rest assured that they'll be okay. And they're pretty much, they're getting it all. And obviously we'll be there for them and to give them all the help and the support that they need. But if we're sending them to yeshiva, and after all we're spending $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a year, so something positive has got to be coming out of that, which is all true. However, we would be obviously gravely mistaken if we thought that we could rely exclusively on yeshivos to transmit the Mesorah to our children, especially those aspects and those parts of the Mesorah which cannot easily be attained in the classroom and through lectures. In fact, it's my opinion, as I've stated before from this pulpit, that the primary purpose of Jewish education, even formal Jewish education, in today's day and age, I think, should be on instilling Jewish values and a love for Torah and a love for mitzvot, and that should be first and foremost, and creating a generation of Torah literate and very, very knowledgeable Jews should be secondary. And just so I not be misunderstood, I'm not suggesting, God forbid, that we put away the Chumashim, or that we don't learn Gemara anymore, and it's not important if they actually know Hebrew. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying when all is said and done, ultimately speaking, what is going to determine whether or not our children will carry the Mesorah and transmit it effectively to the next generation, and what is going to ultimately assure us that our children hopefully be Shomei Shabbos themselves, is not going to depend in all likelihood on how many black Gemara that they learned. And I was most surprised when I heard this first, and I've made this point before because to me it was such a surprise. When I started teaching at MTA 8 years ago, so anybody who at the time started teaching in Yeshiva University had the privilege to spend a few minutes with Rabbi Lamb. And I went into his the chamber, and then the inner chamber, and the inner chamber, and it was, and I sat with him just for a few moments. But I remember that he said this to me, and I was so surprised. Rabbi Lamb being a world-renowned scholar, someone who has written numerous volumes on very scholarly topics, and he said to me, you know, it really doesn't make a difference when all is said and done whether or not the kids in Yeshir are going to learn an extra blad Gemara, or whether you're going to teach them another parak of Chumash. I was very surprised to hear that from him. And he said, what's most important is that you give them a love for learning, and then you give them a love for Torah. And then hopefully they'll take that, and for the rest of their life they will apply it, and they will continue to learn, and halavai, learn all that you want to be able to give to them in this short period of time. Now, I don't think Rabbi Lamb was saying, and I'm certainly not saying to you tonight, that it's not important if our kids are book smart, and it's not important if they can learn Torah on their own. Obviously it is. But when all is said and done, the purpose of Torah is that Torah is supposed to give us a way of life, a system of life, and we need to know how to relate to Torah on many, many different levels. And we have all seen, certainly have from time to time, kids who could be very, very Torah literate and can cite chapter and verse and are very, very impressive when it comes to test taking. But when all is said and done, they have many, many questions in terms of their emunah. They are not inspired. When nobody's looking, they will not put on tefillin, and they are not interested necessarily in this system as a way of life. And obviously, that is something which is tragic, at the very least, and something that we need to seek as educators and as parents to overcome. It's interesting. I heard a thought a number of years ago that we really say this each and every day. And very often the things, again, that we say every day, we fail to realize the significance of those very words. Before Kriya Shema in the morning, there's a tefillah, Avinu Avarachaman, and we ask Hashem in the beginning of that tefillah, V'seimli Beinu Bina Lahavinu Askiyah, we ask Him to give us the wisdom to understand, to learn the depths and the meanings and the intricate details of the Torah. And that is a very, very clear and unambiguous request for the acquisition of Torah knowledge. But then we go on to say more than that. We say that you should enlighten our eyes, that our hearts should cling to the mitzvot. So obviously it's not enough to just simply ask. This was pointed out by Rav Scheinberg Schlieff. It's not enough to just ask for Torah knowledge, but specifically that the Torah should inspire me, it should change me, it should affect my thoughts, my dreams, my values, my goals, etc. Before I came to Teaneck, so I taught an MTA as I do now, but in addition, in the afternoon, I spent a few hours every day, 2 or 3 hours a day, in a chair, sitting with kids on the opposite side. My official title at the time was a religious guidance counselor. Now, I'm not a licensed therapist. I wasn't pretending to be. But basically, it's a professional schmoozer. You sit with kids, and you try to get them to open up if they want, and just to talk about what's on their mind, what are their concerns, what are their fears, what are they happy about, what are they not happy about, what's in school, in their families, at home, etc. And it amazed me how often I found a very, very startling correlation between kids who were successful in school and feeling good about themselves and just overall, you know, what we would call on the right way, on the right derech. And these kids very often would describe their homes, their Shabbos homes, as being very, very pleasant places to be. They would describe the Shabbos table as taking more than a half hour, 45 minutes. They would describe the house where there was a lot of love and nurturing and zmiros, etc. And those kids who didn't have that same experience and who described, I remember one time I asked somebody what his Shabbos table was like, he didn't even understand the question. He came from a religious home, but he didn't understand the expression, the Shabbos table. I said, you know, the place where you eat, you know, your Shabbos meals with your family. He says, we eat Shabbos meals, you know, the kitchen table where we normally eat, and but it's a little different, isn't it? He says, no, not really, you know, this one comes, this one goes. And the way he was unfortunately suffering in so many areas of his life, so when you see this once or twice, so you say it must be a coincidence. But when you see this time and time and time again, so I became convinced at the time that a major force in the religious development of children is the experience that they have at the Shabbos table. And again, it's not all going to come down to the Shabbos table, and you'll find people who came from homes where there were one of the Shabbos tables and they are having troubles and vice versa. But you will find that perhaps one of the most major forces is specifically in this regard. Now, in our generation, I think that we are particularly challenged. We can only speak for ourselves. We weren't around 100 years ago, but it seems to me, and I think most would agree, that we have challenges which our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents didn't share. And that is that we live in a world where basically anything you want, you have access to. If not in real form, then in virtual form. And basically, it's not necessary for the most part for people to use their imaginations anymore. If they want to know what something is like, so they can just experience it or surf the web and find it and get a pretty close, real, accurate feel for what it is that they are searching for. And when we try to give over a sense of spirituality to our children, so we find that we are particularly challenged, because perceiving spirituality means being able to perceive and experience something which cannot be seen with the eyes. And kids, by nature, are certainly wired for that. We know that kids have a very wild imagination, and they love to fantasize, and they love to play house, and then they love to play cops and robbers, and that's what they're all about. But when all is said and done, they don't have too much patience for those who want to try to describe something which is exhilarating and wonderful and uplifting, if they can't really put their hands on it. And depending on how much they trust you, they may give you some time to prove it to them. But ultimately speaking, it's an uphill battle in our generation trying to cultivate and develop a deep sense and appreciation for spirituality, because if it's not on a TV screen, so so then the kids are going to doubt whether it really exists. And in order for kids to appreciate and to love Torah, as we mentioned a few moments ago, so it is necessary for them to feel some sort of spiritual connection. And mitzvot, a life of mitzvot, a life of Torah, has to be as meaningful to them as possible. I remember, I believe it was my oldest daughter, when she first started saying brachos, so she got so excited about it that every time she would put something in her mouth, she would say bracha again and again. So she'd have a bag of jelly beans, she'd make 50 shahakos. So my intuitive reaction was to tell her to stop, to tell her, you know, no, that's not the way you do it, you take one, and then when you finish all this. But I stopped myself because I realized, you know, that this is a bracha. You know, many brachos, but this is a blessing that a parent should have, that every child should be saying too many brachos. If the kids relate to something on some level, so you never want to stop them, even if they're a little off, and even if they're not doing it exactly the way it's supposed to be done. Now again, everything that I'm saying could be easily misunderstood, and I trust the crowd here will not misunderstand that which I'm saying. If, for example, a 13 or 14 year old boy is putting on tefillin for the first time and he's so excited about it, but he's putting the tefillin on his leg or he's putting on his arm completely backwards, so I'm not going to say shh, don't, just leave him alone, let him enjoy it. Obviously it's our job to show him the right way to perform mitzvot. But then again, we cannot expect, and we shouldn't expect, that our kids are going to want to do things the way we do it and the way we've always done it. And I can't stress this enough. Very often, parents are very well-intentioned. Parents, hopefully, are always well-intentioned. And they want very, very much to train their kids properly when it comes to Torah mitzvot. But when we are too critical, in general, of our kids, and this could be applied in all areas of life, but when we are too critical of the way that they do express whatever sense and appreciation of spirituality they may have, so we run the risk of turning them off, you know, slowly but surely. We want to be as nurturing and as positive about these expressions as possible, and obviously within limits we can and we should guide them and show them, but never cut them off and never be too critical when, after all, they are trying and they're searching to have that connection that we speak about. As I mentioned before, it appears to me that the Shabbos table is an area forum where spirituality can be cultivated and developed more so than anything else, and so therefore, as the topic of tonight's lecture I think made clear, we're going to devote ourselves tonight for the most part talking about ways to enhance the Shabbos table again from a spiritual religious perspective. If we have time at the end, so I'll be happy to discuss other issues that people may have on their mind, but I did put some time into trying to relate to as many different points about the Shabbos table as possible. These are in no particular order, and feel free to interject, interrupt, to question, comment, or critique along the way. First of all, and I guess even though these are no particular order, this is the most important aspect of the Shabbos table. The Shabbos table should be as positive and enjoyable for our children as is possible. And this is more important than anything else. This is, again, what's going to make the difference. This is what's going to keep their interest. And this is what's going to make them want to come back for more. And ultimately what will stay in their minds when they're not sitting at the Shabbos table. While ideally the Shabbos table does provide a wonderful forum for Torah learning and for Torah discussions and for talking about the parasha and for testing and quizzing our children, there's no question about it. It's a wonderful opportunity, but that is not the primary goal. And our children should not come to the Shabbos table feeling as if they're being tested, as if they are being subjected to an entire battery of questions based on the parasha Shavua, and we'll discuss ways that we can talk in learning with our children a little later. But again, before I sit down to the table, I have to remind myself that the purpose of this meal, as far as I'm concerned, is to make it as positive and enjoyable for my children as possible. Number one, that will build a context for a positive religious experience, which is obviously very important. It will, in all likelihood, build self-esteem, because kids will be around other members of the family feeling good about themselves and their surroundings. And it will strengthen family relationships, which, needless to say, is extremely important as well. Many people we know who do not have the opportunity to observe and to have a regular Shabbos table when they experience it for the first time, either actively or sometimes passively sitting on the side, so they will be very, very turned on, and more so by this than anything else. When they see the way a cohesive, functional family can sit together and people can relate to each other in a positive way, so this is something that's very exciting to people from the outside and people who do not necessarily have this as part of their regular experience within their own family. So this is obviously three very important positive outcomes for making the Shabbos table as positive and enjoyable for the children as possible. Along these lines, there should be no pressure at the Shabbos table. I'm not saying there should be no pressure at all in life, and I'm not saying we should never pressure our kids, but at the Shabbos table should be a relaxed environment. Kids tend to enjoy themselves more when they are given space, when they are given freedom, when they are given the right to do what they want, how they want, when they want. And so therefore, along, you know, again, those lines of what we just said, that we're trying to make it as enjoyable as possible, we have to make it relaxed. Kids should never be forced to perform publicly or privately. I know that from time to time we may think and maybe even say to our kids, in front of our kids, they may hear, they may not, why am I spending so much money on yeshiva tuition if he comes home and he can't even say one divide Torah? That's a very it's a very good question, and it's something that perhaps you know, you should be thinking and figure out a way to address if there is indeed an issue. But it's not the type of thing that you ever want to say at the Shabbos table. You never want to, again, express a disappointment of your children at such a time. And this can be applied in many other areas. I'm going to try to stick to the Shabbos table, but one other area, again, where I see this time and time again, I have the advantage of being approximately 7 inches higher than everybody else in the shul, so I can see a little more. And, you know, not every child can sit in shul, and not every child can sit anywhere. You know, most 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds can't sit in shul, so I blame the certainly the parents more often than not than the kids for bringing such young children to shul. But even sometimes 6, 7, 8, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, they come to shul and they don't know how to sit, and that's an issue and it needs to be dealt with. But to berate the child, to snap at him, to smack him or her in shul could be very, very dangerous. It could have very, very negative outcomes. And again, in a different context, perhaps that would be appropriate. But since we're, again, trying to build and to foster just positive feelings in shul and at the Shabbos table, we have to be very careful not to be critical, too critical anyway, in such an environment. We know that in chinuch, and I'm sure that this is a concept that you're going to hear about a lot over the next few weeks, there's a concept based on a pasuk of Mishlei of Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darko, that we try to educate and to train and to lead and to guide our children, each one according to his way. And it's become a very catchy phrase. It's become the slogan for pretty much every yeshiva in the world. It's what they'll put on their invitation to the dinner, and it's what they'll put on the awards, because we can't come up with too many better ones. But it's a very beautiful pasuk, and there are many, many different ways to explain what exactly it means. It's a very nice phrase, but it's very difficult to apply. For those who, thank God, are blessed to have more than one child, so you know that no two children are the same. And it's a tremendous challenge when one child has a certain set of tendencies and certain talents and abilities, and the other one is completely different. It's very, very difficult. Almost impossible, but I don't think it's really impossible, to have them all together in the same room and try to bring out the unique qualities of each one without in any way offending or boring or upsetting or making the other one jealous. We should find that from time to time we are saying things to our kids, like when they'll say something that's not fair. So we have to respond to that in a way of saying, well, you know, it's not a question of being fair or not, but this is for you and this is for her. And that's true at the Shabbos table as well. I heard a story, I believe I said it from the pulpit a few months ago, but I'll repeat it now for those of you who didn't hear it, and even if you did, it's a great story. I heard this on a tape from Rabbi Dov Brizak, who's actually a nephew, I believe, right, of Dr. Klein. Rabbi Brizak has a yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, and he is very involved with kids who are off the derech, again, as the expression goes, and you'll forgive me, I don't mean it in an offensive way at all, and has a lot of experience in interaction with families and with kids who are having difficulties in the religious context, the religious environment. So there was a particular gentleman who had a large family and was having a very difficult time settling his Shabbos table down because he had one kid who was always jumping up all over the place, and he would spend so much time and energy in trying to get this kid to be quiet that there was always hefkeres at the Shabbos table, and he never could bring order to a Shabbos table, and it was becoming a source of tremendous friction in the home. So he went to his Rebbe, apparently, I don't remember who it was, if he said the name, but some renowned posek in Eretz Yisrael, and he gave him a very, very surprising piece of advice. He told him to buy a trampoline and to take a small trampoline and put it next to this kid's seat. And when they start seeing Shalom Aleichem, so the kid should jump up and down on the trampoline, and this way it'll at least have a way to express himself and in a certain way, and he won't be jumping off the table, and the tablecloth won't be falling on the floor. He'll get to get all out all of his energy, and everybody else will sit there. And you know, obviously, the person who raised the question thought that he was out of his mind. What kind of ridiculous suggestion is that? But from what I understand, he tried it, and it worked. What does it mean it worked? I mean, it's still probably the only place in the world where you find a trampoline at the shop at a Shabbos table. But it worked that things got better. You've seen one also? In the dining room. Wow, look at that. Okay. So maybe they heard the story and maybe they realized, maybe they heard it somewhere else. I don't know. But it worked because it brought Seder. It brought the Seder and it was able to eliminate the hefkeres that it was feeling beforehand. And I think maybe in this case, I don't know the family, I can't say, but maybe the father felt that his concerns were and his fears were somewhat put to rest, and were his, whatever concerns he had were validated by hearing from a renowned Torah scholar, not putting him down and telling him he has to seatbelt his kids to the chair and not let him move, but say that if this is the way Hashem made your kid, that he's got a lot of energy and he can't seem to sit down, then don't try to suppress that. So he'll be unhappy and nothing's going to happen at the table. Do what you can do with it. Channel it in the right direction. So this kid, again, would get up every week and Shalom Aleichem would jump on the trampoline. It should be. It's not as realistic, however, to expect a classroom to run on that level because of the fact, obviously, that that which we're trying to do at the Shabbos table is not what we're trying to do in the classroom. Right. Right, within reason. A trampoline in the classroom, I don't know that would work. But again, you know, what do I know? Right. No, for sure. Obviously, there are certain experiments that perhaps we can introduce to the Shabbos table, which I don't think would necessarily work in a typical classroom setting. But the concept certainly remains the same. Yeah.
Going along the same line, if you have tips and feedback, let me know. But I think one of the key words you said is at the table. I guess the question is, does it have to be at the table? In other words, I have two kinds of Shabbos. Probably
right.
A lot of people have the same experience. I have one kind of Shabbos, which is just the family, and the kids usually sit at the table. As soon as you invite another family over,
we're going to talk. So we'll talk about that. No, that's okay. You know, we're going to try to talk about how to balance family and guests, something which I struggle with on a regular basis. I'm not sure I have all the answers, but I will try to address it as well. Now, if you've prepared before the Shabbos table, and that's an idea that maybe I'll stress first the importance of preparation. We all prepare. I shouldn't say we all. I do very little to prepare food for the Shabbos table, but we all prepare in some ways and other for Shabbos. Food, obviously, and we put a tremendous amount of time and effort in advance. Some people bake their own challah, some don't, but everybody's putting a lot of special love and care into some parts of the Shabbos table. We shouldn't expect to get wonderful results out of our Torah interaction, Torah discussions with our children if we're not going to prepare for this in advance. And so therefore, along those lines, if we have different kids, different ages, and different levels, so we need to give some thought beforehand as to how we're going to try to hook each one, again, at the same time. And I just gave over here just a model, little example over here that maybe to give an idea of how you could perhaps even conduct one conversation with the entire family on different levels. So, for example, Moshe, on what day did Hashem make the fish? So if Moshe is, 5 or 6 years old, so he probably learned that week. Remembers it was day 3, day 4, 5. Okay, whatever, he'll get the right answer. Devorah, what was created first, the sun or Adam? Okay, so that's a different type of question. Shlomo, according to Rashi, what did Hashem create on Shabbos? And Shira, how many days did it take to create the world? So, all questions about Masa Bereshis, but different types of questions. No one's tuning out, and there's something for everyone, but I'm not asking my sixth grader a question that's way beneath him that he's going to find, he's going to say it's a baby question. And I'm not asking the six-year-old a question that's going to be way over her head. So week after week after week, she's just going to get a feel like I never know the answers to any of the questions anyway. And again, that's what we want to try to avoid. It's very difficult not to be tired at the Shabbos table. It's something which I have yet to figure out how actually not to be tired at the Shabbos table. However, I can only tell you that if you can figure out a way to rest for Shabbos, as funny as that sounds, I think it would be kedai. You can't afford to fall asleep at your Shabbos table. It's, again, a very, very critical time with your children. It's bad form, and it can have again, over time, very negative consequences. We're all human, and from time to time, we're going to fall asleep. That will happen, but it shouldn't be that our kids think of the Shabbos table and just think of, you know, Abba with his nose in the soup. That's not gonna ultimately inspire him very much to have a Shabbos table when he gets older. If our kids see that we are energized and that we are interested and that we are excited, so they will follow suit. They will, over time, if not immediately, find that to be exciting, find that to be wonderful and enjoyable. Seeing that Mommy and Abba are into something, so then that they'll get into it as well. If they find again that we're very laid back and we're very blasé about the whole meal and we just wanted to get it over with, so we can't expect that they are going to come out with a different feeling, with a different message. Very often our kids come home with a lot of discussion material from school, depending on where we send our kids to school and how much they prepare them for Parshas Shavuot. You may get one sheet, you may get two, three, four, five, sometimes you get 10, and every kid wants you perhaps to read the sheets and wants you to read everybody who in the school had a baby that week and everybody who's who's being honored at some dinner, and it can become very time consuming, and we can easily fall into the trap of tuning out our other kids. So here as well, it's not easy, and it's probably impossible, completely unrealistic to expect this of anyone in the winter months. But now in the summer, even if you make early Shabbos, which is at 7 o'clock, it is possible to take 10 or 15 minutes before Shabbos to take each and every one of those sheets that your kids have and to quickly scan them and find one or two important points of interest, and then you can bring them to your table, and how special your kids will feel if by the time, they're coming to the table to show them what they did this week, and you say, I already read it, and I saw this, and this was such a beautiful thing. Why don't you explain to everybody, what it says over here? Question number 3. The idea is, again, that I'm taking the time beforehand, and I'm not going to be overwhelmed and inundated in sheets and sheets and sheets, which it's impossible to sort through and make any sense of at the table. Another possibility, it was mentioned before, and we're going to get to guests a little later, but it was mentioned that there are certain kids who can sit at the table longer than others. If you know that one of your children will never make it at the Shabbos table more than 10 minutes, so obviously you want to try to address that child first, and the other ones a little later. And that goes without saying. It's along the lines of having an energetic, lively Shabbos table. It's very important to sing at the Shabbos table. Now, some people are natural singers. Some people enjoy singing more than others. It's difficult to tell someone who doesn't have a good voice and doesn't carry a tune well and doesn't really know any good songs to sing, because they're not really going to get into it that easily. So here as well, it takes some preparation. There are tapes and CDs out there which have all the Shabbos tunes and Shabbos songs, and in all likelihood, if you put again a little effort into it beforehand, you can put together sometimes a short repertoire of songs, but one that will be again over time engaging and inviting for your kids. They may initially say that it's something that they don't find cool, they don't like it, depending on how old your kids are. They may tune in, they may tune out, but it's important, again, that we create that context where there is happiness at the table, and singing is a way very often that we can demonstrate that. Personally, I have very, very powerful memories of singing at my Shabbos table. And truth be told, it was not a very, very Leibetic Shabbos table. It's not appropriate to start saying which member of my family sang more than others, but it's not that it was, you know, Shabbos table we sang for 3 hours. But the memories that I have of sitting with one of my parents in particular and being taught specific songs are treasured memories, and God only knows, because I don't know, how much of an impact that has in terms of shaping one's religious sensitivity and personality. So it's important that we include that aspect of the meal as well, to having a lot of singing. In terms of the balance between guests and kids, so again, the question's better than the answer, because there will always be a conflict of sorts, because I'm going to want very much to entertain and to be respectful to my guests. But it can be, certainly on a regular basis, but perhaps it could never be the exclusion of my own kids, my own family. A reminder that charity begins at the home, and reaching out to our kids and inspiring them at the Shabbos table is a form of charity in this respect. And so therefore, we can't afford to focus on a guest exclusion of our kids. I would suggest the following. I'm not going to say that I always do this. If I'm thought out beforehand and focused, and I know who my guests are, and I can listen, every meal will be different. But I think that in all likelihood, whoever you're going to invite to your Shabbos table will not be offended at all, and will not feel slighted at all if you spend the first 15-20 minutes of your Shabbos table focused on your kids. I can't imagine that they're going to walk out of there saying, you know, these people, they were so obnoxious to me, the first 20 minutes they hardly said a word to me. If they realize what you're doing and they see what you're doing, and then after, as usually happens, after a certain period of time, however long it is, the kids are going to tend to migrate from the table anyway. They'll come back for a little, they'll be in and out, but the point is, once I have them, I'm not going to lose them now. I think that will obviously go a long way with your kids. Whether they realize it or not, that's what we're trying to accomplish. And I don't think you're gonna run the risk of scaring these guests away, that they'll never come back again. Intuitively, that's what we sometimes feel. We feel almost this need to first address our guests and to ask questions and how are you and what's your name. But it's important for kids to see that. It's important for kids to see welcoming guests. And focusing on your kids doesn't have to be to the absolute exclusion of everyone else in the room. But we have to attend to our children first, and usually first is going to mean chronologically, and if not, we're going to have to make sure that we give them proper attention at each and every meal. I don't always have my kids sit next to me. I did hear a story. Somebody told me, if I'm not mistaken, I don't even remember the details of this story, but I believe maybe it was even Moshe Feinstein Zatzal, that I heard that he would always have his children sit right next to him, regardless of who was at the table. And I'm sure over the years there were many, many very, very esteemed guests at Ramosha's table, but his children would always be at his side. And again, I imagine over time, not just as, it doesn't just make the kids feel good, but it keeps them within range, and they'll know that you're focused on them. I did insist that at the Seder, for example, my kids be at my side, and I'm not saying it's only once a year, but there are certain times that we're focused, and we know, let's not forget, the purpose of tonight is the kids. But again, every Friday night is an opportunity, and every Shabbos is an opportunity, and to arrange a table so that all the guests are right here and the kids are at the side, or even from time to time in another room on a small kitchen table. I'm not going to tell you that we never do it, but it shouldn't be done regularly, and it should be done, you know, only if they're very, very extenuating circumstances. It shouldn't be that every time we have guests, that our kids feel, and even if they'll tell you, they won't be insulted. You know, they'll tell you, that's okay, we don't mind, we like sitting in the kitchen. That's not a good plan. Again, from time to time, things are going to come up, but for the long run, our goal should be to keep our kids as close to us during the meal as possible. Yeah.
You know, communication of your intentions is a wonderful thing, like a tool that we could use with our guests also. So let them know up front, by the way, I hope you don't mind, but our minute here is that we give the kids attention up front, and
right,
have plenty of time to talk later on, so why let them guess?
Right. 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 We don't have to keep them guessing. We could tell them up front. I think, you certainly could, but I don't think you know, anyone will question it. I think people will realize right away. I know that my father-in-law has many, many little gimmicks that I've observed over the years, which are just part of his personality. But at the Shabbos table in particular, he has this trick which he uses to get people into it. And he'll say, let's say, he'll turn to Heshy, and he'll say, Heshy, do you hear the question Howard asked me? So Howard's sitting in the back of the table. He has no, and all of a sudden Howard's ears perk up. Well, I didn't ask him anything, and all of a sudden he feels nervous. And he said, Howard wants to know, you know, why is it that that Yaakov did this to Rachel? So all of a sudden, you know, you're involved, you know, Howard's involved, and there's a discussion around the table. And you could do that with the kids and the guests as well. You know, you could turn to one of your kids and just say, "Do you hear what Heshy asked me?" You could turn to Heshy and just say, "Do you hear what my daughter asked me?" But in this way, focusing on one doesn't have to be, again, to exclusion of the others, and there are ways that you can work with the crowd to try to bring people in together. Obviously, the more outgoing you are, and obviously I hope with your family we're not inhibited in that regard, and the more that I'm willing to be creative and spontaneous, so the more opportunities I'll have to reach out to them in this regard. It shouldn't feel like it's scripted and that I have to do this in such in a specific orderly manner. But over time, we may develop certain techniques that enable us to reach out to everyone at the same time. Yeah.
Also, I think if you have another family over with children around the same age as your own children, involve your guest kids as well. Yeah. And especially if your kids are in the same class or in the same grade in the same school, basically what they're doing, involve them to it'll make their parents feel like knowing.
Right. Right, and if you just say, sometimes you have younger kids, if you just say the word contest, you know, it's amazing, you know, the results you get. And then, of course, you need prizes afterwards. I get burned with that all the time. But, you know, contest. you know, every kid at the table, you know, under a certain age, granted, you know, once they reach a certain age, you know, nothing is going to be that easy. But certainly with younger children, if you're telling them that there's a contest of sorts, again, assuming that you're not, by design of that contest, they're going to exclude anyone who simply cannot compete, and if so, you have to come up with a way to cover for that or to compensate for that, then that would be a great way to include all the kids automatically, because kids, as we know, love competing. I think, as I said a moment ago, it's important to be creative and not to make any assumptions. We've all seen you know, many, many different Shabbos tables, and we may have in our mind what we consider to be the ideal, the paradigmatic Shabbos table, and there are certain guidelines and certain limitations. And I'm not suggesting that we do Kiddush at the end and that we, you know, we bench in the beginning. Nothing drastic and radical like that. But I am suggesting that we think out of the box. And we do think we shouldn't be scared to experiment. It'll keep our kids, again, interested, and it'll keep it exciting for us. A couple of ideas, and these are just ideas, what I mean along these lines. There is a minhag that I developed in my own home. It's probably done by accident, but it's one of my favorite times of the week. And I like to think it's one of my kids' favorite times of the week as well, although I don't know. And that is that when I give them a bracha Friday night, so instead of just saying, you know, Yisimcha Elokim, and giving them a kiss and walking them away, so I try to give them all their own special message. Now, it could be complimenting them on something they said or did earlier that day. It could be telling them, you know, saying how beautiful you look in your dress. Or it could be saying something very funny and totally nothing to do with anything having to do with Shabbos at the Shabbos table. But every kid, you know, is expecting that private personal message. No kid ever asks, what did he say to you? What did he say to you? What did happen in my family is that Shira, who's my third, started asking if she could say something back, and now she and your soul do that, and it's all a game, and now they say something back in my ear, so fine. I never hear what they're saying, I never know what they're saying, but the idea is that you know, there's that interaction, and there's something special, and it's different than just a Shabbos bracha, but I think, you know, hopefully over time it makes it more meaningful. I mentioned before the importance of singing. I think it's important to let kids sing what they want, obviously within reason, even if it's not in the bencher. My daughter Tzipora loved for a while singing Lucha Dodi, and she would come to the Shabbos table Friday night and Shabbos and sing Lucha Dodi, and the guests thought that we were crazy, that it was a little strange. I never heard of this minute, you sing Lucha Dodi. So some asked, and some didn't ask, but she loved it. This is what they sang at school. They sang it at the Shabbat party, and she loved it. And she would sing the whole thing from beginning to end of Chagodi. So again, it's not, you know, you never want to say to your kids who are singing at the Shabbat table, that's actually a Friday night song. You shouldn't be singing that now. That's silly. I mean, it's true that there are Friday night miros and Shabbat miros, but if your kids are singing at the Shabbat table, then just don't silence them. And if they're singing a Yom Tov song, if they're singing something which is not a Shabbat song, as long as it's obviously within the guidelines of Shirei Kodesh and it's not offensive for the Shabbat table. And even there, you know, you have to know what's right for your family. There are hopefully certain songs that everybody will deem inappropriate at the Shabbat table. But even if I'm not even going to give examples, but if there's a family song, if there's a song that you like singing in the car sometimes, and it just happens to come up at the Shabbos table, so I'm not sure necessarily that you want to you want to smother that because it's a Shabbos table. You have to know again what's to be gained and what's to be lost. Something I would suggest, if it will work, and if not, there's no need necessarily to do this, but if your kids, again, do have a lot of energy, as sometimes kids do, if you want to even get up to dance sometimes at your Shabbos table, it sounds crazy, and it sounds funny, and that's ridiculous, and I've never heard of such a thing, but, you know, they may think it's weird the first time you do it, and I'm not saying you should do it every week, but doing spontaneous things like that, which again will generate excitement and energy, is I think a good idea. Developing, especially as kids get older, more sophisticated forms of games or cards or questions, there are many resources available to us, many of which we may not even be aware of. I'll just mention one in particular, which I think is a great thing, especially for those who have older kids. I haven't visited their website in a very long time, but the Orthodox Caucus, I imagine the website has only been developed further since I saw it last, but had, initially when the Orthodox Caucus was developed about, I don't know, 6-7 years ago, so they had been sending out to the various communities pamphlets which discuss certain areas of interest. So for example, one topic would be covered abrios, and they would raise certain, they would present these scenarios. You know, and they had scenarios for almost every different age level. So they have for 5- and 7-year-olds. You know, you're outside and you're playing in the playground, and one of the kids can't play well, and nobody wants to be on their team. You know, and they create some scenario. What do you do? And then they have, you know, a similar dilemma. You know, for 9- and 10-year-olds, and then for adults. And you can throw these things out at the Shabbos table. You don't have to have any material prepared. You don't have to even have the answers, but it sparks conversation on areas of human interest. I mean, they're all hopefully going to come back to some Torah concept, but that's not necessarily the absolute goal. You're just raising questions, dilemmas. I mean, they're great. I mean, again, and if your kids love math problems and love these math puzzles, so every once in a while to throw a math puzzle out at the table, at the Shabbos table, is not at all inappropriate, in addition to whatever sort of Torah trivia questions you want to ask. But the Orthodox Caucus, it may be oc.org, I'm not sure, but it's easy to find, does have available on their website these sorts of dilemmas on numerous topics. And YU, they used to have the dorm talks. So at one point I started collecting all the dorm talks. So they used to have, I don't know if they even still have them, but once or twice a semester, so they would have a few of the personalities of Yeshiva talk about, you know, again, these types of issues, of racial issues, of issues within society, dealing with non-Jews. These are all, you know, areas of interest on many, many different age levels. And it would be appropriate to, again, to prepare these sort of trigger questions in advance. It's a way to keep people involved, and you'll be surprised sometimes. Whereas beforehand, you know, the Shabbat table will end in a half hour, 45 minutes, an hour, nothing to do. So this could easily, you know, fill a lot of time without anybody around the table realizing it. I've never been at Rabbi Neuberger's table, so I don't know the details of this, but somebody recently told me that they have some very, very interesting game that they play at the table. Obviously, it's on a higher level, but I think Rebbetzin Neuberger does something really neat where she, I think, finds some really obscure word in the Parsha and Rashi, and you have to find it, but it's not just that. It gets very interesting. And the point is, I'm sure she puts in some time in advance in order to do this, but she comes to the Shabbat table, she throws out these things, and all of a sudden, you know, everyone's involved, and it's not an easy question that everybody can necessarily answer. Another way to get people involved around the Shabbos table without having them to need to prepare anything in advance is by having a book at your Shabbos table that you can easily open up to any point and ask somebody to read. This is, again, something else that I learned from my father-in-law, but it's, you know, there's always someone at the table who feels a little out of place. And if you have, let's say, a few families over, so I'm just trying to think, you know, let's say, you know, a 13 or 14 year old girl, you know, a lot of little kids at the table, a lot of adults at the table, and she just started sort of there, and she doesn't feel that she fits in. So if you have a book, you know, if you have the Maggid Speaks, so you have Pnina Malatoro, you have any one of these English books, you can open up and she'll read two paragraphs. So all of a sudden, she hasn't prepared anything in advance, assuming obviously that she can read. I don't mean that as a joke, God forbid. You know, obviously you don't want to make anybody feel uncomfortable if she's not able to read easily. But assuming that she's able to handle whatever you're putting before her, whether the Hebrew is transliterated or whether the entire paragraph is in Hebrew, everyone on their level, so it's a great way to involve someone without them having to prepare anything. You're not putting anyone on the spot. No one's being asked to give answers or to any questions, etc. Benching out loud with the kids is a very important thing to do. Sometimes it feels like an eternity. Really feel like an eternity. And depending on, you know, how short Shabbos is, I mean, there are certain weeks in the winter where I sometimes have to end the Shabbos table just so I can head off to the Daf Yomi, which is an hour and 10 minutes before Mincha. And that's how close it is sometimes. So I know that, especially during the winter, we count out our minutes. But now again, we're beginning the summer season, and I hope that some of this could be implemented sooner than later. And so therefore, to think along these lines, especially if your kids are still younger. If they're older already, so you may be past that point. But it's an investment of 5, 6, or 7 minutes, but it can have very, very positive results. First of all, your kids will learn the benching better than they will otherwise. They'll bench better than they will otherwise. You will bench better than you will otherwise. That goes without saying. You cannot compare someone who benches. And even though the song, the tune that we use for Birkas HaMazon is not particularly inspiring at all, sometimes if you stop and just think about how absurd that tune is for the words, it's almost upsetting. But in all likelihood, it's better than what you're doing without it. We sometimes, in my house, you know, we'll end the singing at midway through, you know, after Li'olama Yechasreinu. I'm not sure why. I don't know whoever made that up. It's a terrible message. Now, I understand why. I understand there's a difference between the first four brachos and the rest of benching, which is not, quote-unquote, as important. But if we do that every week, we're sending a very strange message to our kids. We're really telling them that this is a really important part of benching and this is not so important. So again, if you're running from time to time, it's important for the kids to know, you know, there's a difference, and from here to the end, you'll do it quietly. But I remember I used to go to camp. They used to do that all the time. So I mean, you're pretty much telling the kids, you know, benching's over now. And now just mutter to yourself for 2 minutes and then we'll dismiss you. And that's, again, you shouldn't be doing that every week. Yeah.
Right. And they get excited about benching, and the kids love it. I mean, they ask for shifting.
Right.
If they have time to bench, they come running because they know shifting
right.
is coming.
Right, so we actually probably about a year ago, I started having benching contest. I decided that I didn't have a problem with that. At one point, I didn't like doing that. I didn't want to give out prizes for benching, but then I thought about it long and hard, and I discussed it with people, and I had no problem with it anymore. So now we have these benching contests. So it's another just way to get the kids to the table. Most kids will still, you know, even though it's almost a given at this point that if you come to the table and you bench, you're going to get something at the end. It's still called a contest, which is really not, because, I mean... you know, and in fact, we had a guest at the table a couple of months ago, and he was also benching very nicely. He was about 35 years old, but I know that he likes drinking, so I took in my pocket a little one of those like little scotch bottles, and I threw it to him afterwards, and we got a good laugh out of it. But the idea is that, you know, you can give prizes to everyone on their level. It's important, as always, to realize that we teach our children by example. And again, I imagine that this is a theme that will resurface again and again over the next few weeks at the various shiurim and the various lectures. But, you know, we can try to lecture to our kids from today till tomorrow, but the way we really teach them is by example. Our kids will enjoy spiritual endeavors and spirituality if we do, And if we don't, it's going to be very difficult for us to preach to them. I heard from Rabbi Brizak as well, where he told a story, which you don't know whether to laugh or cry when you hear the story, about a kid who was in class, and the Rebbe asked, "Everybody, tell me what you think is the most important thing in the world." So one kid said, Shabbos, and the other one said Tefillin. It sounded like this was somewhere in Bnei Brak, the way he was describing the answers. And the other one said, Torah, and some kid said Shalom. So the Rebbe wanted to kick him out. Maybe he did kick him out. He thought he was making a joke, and he didn't find it funny. So he told him that, and he asked him afterwards, why'd you say that? So the kid insisted that he was serious, and he said, "Why? Because at his Shabbos table, and that's like the focus of the table. Like they sing, and his father's not interested, and they tell the Torah, his father's not listening. He's reading the newspaper, this and that." They bring out the show, and all of a sudden his father's eyes widen and his mouth starts to water. So this was a 7-8-year-old kid who thought that the most important thing in the world was showing. Nobody would ever want their kids to get that message, but we have to realize again that over time, through our behavior, the very, very strong messages are brought forth to our children. That's really what Chinuch is all about. Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal pointed out that we often use the word hashpa, that we want to have hashpa on others. We want to be mashpia, which means we want to influence. But that comes from the word, the shorash of the word is shefa, which means to overflow. Now when I'm full with something and flows out from over me, so then it can reach other people. But if it's not really something that relates to me, it's not something that I find meaningful, so then it's going to be very difficult to transmit this to other kids. I'm a little out of order over here, but an idea just popped into mind. I know that years ago when I was in West Orange, so I was giving probably just a weekly drush on a similar sort of topic, and I suggested that people have a sefer at their table, which they learn a little bit from every week. And every week you learn a little bit more, and over time you finish it. So it could be the Chafetz Chaim's lesson a day, and even though it's a lesson a day, you'll make it a lesson a week. It could be a muktzah book, it could be a halacha book, it could be a story book, whatever it is. And I just mentioned it, I didn't even think about it. And 2 years later, so I was invited to join a family. They were going out to eat, they were making a siyum on Pirkei Avos. And they invited me, so I said, "No, thank you very much." And they said, "No, we're making it in your honor." So I said, "That's a little strange." And they told me, because it was my idea. So I didn't know what they were talking about. I remember I gave this idea, but somebody was listening, and they right, and they took the idea, and they really ran with it. So in other words, that if there could be, again, a little something you do every week, and over time, you make a seum, so that's wonderful. Not that that's, again, the goal of it all, but that's a wonderful outcome of something like that. So we should be as creative. And again, continue to think out of the box and not allow ourselves to continue to play by that which we perceive to be, the rules for a Shabbos table. Any other questions? Okay. I would just like to say in conclusion, I did start off by saying that spirituality, and specifically teaching our children to appreciate and to perceive spiritual matters, is something which is very challenging to us in our generation. That is true. However, I do believe, and I think that you all do as well, not only by virtue of the fact that you're here, but I think most people, mature adults, do realize that it can be achieved, but we shouldn't give up. Despite the fact that our kids are so drawn and attracted to so many of the cultural lures around them, and to what extent we should be limiting that, that's a discussion for another time. But even if you are going to have a very, very insular home, and you have a lot of control over what comes into your home and what your kids watch and what they see, we all know that our kids are exposed to so much, which is so tantalizing and exciting to them in every which way. Despite all that, it is not only possible, is it possible to teach them and to show them and to hopefully guide them to seek and to appreciate spirituality, but ultimately that's really what they're seeking. That's really what they're looking for. That's what everybody's looking for. People are looking for happiness, and people are looking to feel content. And we have the answers. I don't usually talk in such an arrogant way. You know, would normally be so presumptuous to say we have all the answers, but in this regard we do have the answers. We know that with all of the excitement of the world around us, there's really very, very little there substantive that can offer our kids for everlasting happiness. If we can show them an alternative, which is meaningful, which is real, which is something which is perceivable over time, then they will appreciate it, they will cling to it, and they will carry it with them for the rest of their lives. And hopefully, with God's help, that obviously cannot be overestimated at all, but with God's help, we will succeed in raising our children on the Derech of Torah. Thank you very much, and have a wonderful night. And it's too early to say good Shabbos, but in light of tonight's learning, have a wonderful Shabbos.
Family and Jewish tradition will be presenting.